All else being equal, it has been known for many years that smaller, more intimate schools create better learning environments than megaplex houses of learning. The brain rule may help explain why smaller is better. Given that every brain is wired differently, being able to read a student's mind is a powerful tool in the hands of a teacher. As you may recall from the evolution chapter, theory of mind is about as close to mind reading as humans are likely to get. It is defined as the ability to understand the interior motivations of someone else and the ability to construct a predictable theory of how their mind works based on that knowledge. This gives teachers critical access to their students' interior educational life. It may include knowledge of when students are confused and when they are fully engaged. It also gives sensitive teachers valuable feedback about whether their teaching is being transformed into learning. It may even be the definition of that sensitivity. I have come to believe that people with advanced theory of mind skills possess the single most important ingredient for becoming effective communicators of information. Students comprehend complex knowledge at different times and at different depths. Because a teacher can keep track of only so many minds, there must be a limit on the number of students in a class. The smaller, the better. It is possible that small class sizes predict better performance simply because the teacher can keep better track of where everybody is. This suggests that an advanced skill set in theory of mind predicts a good teacher. If so, existing theory of mind tests could be used like Myers-Briggs personality tests to reveal good teachers from bad, or to help people considering careers as teachers. Customized instruction. What of that old admonition to create more individualized instruction within a grade level? It sits on some solid brain science. Researcher Carol McDonald Connor is doing the first work I've seen capable of handling these differences head-on. She and a colleague combined a standard reading program with a bright and shiny new computer program called A2i. The software uses artificial intelligence to determine where the user's reading competencies lie and then adaptively tailor exercises for the student in order to fill in any gaps. When used in conjunction with a standard reading class, the software is wildly successful. The more students work with the program, the better their scores become. Interestingly, the effect is greatest when the software is used in conjunction with a normal reading program. Teacher alone, or software alone, is not as effective. As the instructor teaches the class in a normal fashion, students will, given the uneven intellectual landscape, experience learning gaps. Left untreated, these gaps cause students to fall further and further behind, a normal and insidious effect of not being able to transform instruction into apprehension. The software makes sure these gaps don't go untreated. Is this the future? Attempting to individualize education is hardly a new idea. Using code as a stand-in for human teaching is not revolutionary either, but the combination might be a stunner. I would like to see a three-pronged research effort between brain and education scientists. Number one, evaluate teachers and teachers-to-be for advanced theory of mind skills using one of the four main tests that measure empathy. Determine whether this affects student performance in a statistically valid fashion. Number two, develop adaptive software for a variety of subjects and grade levels. Test them for efficacy. Deploy the ones that work in a manner similar to the experiment Connor published in the journal Science. Number three, test both ideas in various combinations. Add to the mix environments where the student-teacher ratio is both typical and optimized, and then compare the results. The reason to do this is straightforward. You cannot change the fact that the human brain is individually wired. Every student's brain, every employee's brain, every customer's brain, each is wired differently. That's the brain rule. You can either accede to it or ignore it. The current system of education chooses the latter to our detriment. It needs to be torn down and newly envisioned in a Manhattan Project-sized commitment to individualizing instruction. We might, among other things, dismantle altogether grade structures based on age. These ideas are portable to the workplace, whether it's theory of mind screening for leaders or a method of mass customization that treats every employee as an individual. You may discover that you have a great basketball player in your organization and that you're asking him to play baseball. For your review, here's a summary of the chapter. Let's review the chapter. Wiring. Rule number 5. Every brain is wired differently. What you do and learn in life physically changes what your brain looks like. It literally rewires it. The various regions of the brain develop at different rates in different people. No two people's brains store the same information in the same way, in the same place. We have a great number of ways of being intelligent, many of which don't show up on an IQ test.
A tutorial of the chapter is available at www.brainrulesbook.com.
Attention. Rule number 6. We don't pay attention to boring things. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning when I was suddenly startled into consciousness by the presence of a small spotlight sweeping across the walls of our living room. In the moonlight, I could see the 6-foot frame of a young man in a trench coat, clutching a flashlight and examining the contents of our house. His other hand held something metallic, glinting brightly in the silvery light. As my sleepy brain was immediately and violently aroused, it struck me that my home was about to be robbed by someone younger than me, bigger than me, and in possession of a firearm. Heart pounding, knees shaking, I crept to the phone, quickly called the police, turned on the lights, went to stand guard outside my children's room, and prayed. Miraculously, a police car was already in the vicinity and activated its sirens within a minute of my phone call. This all happened so quickly that my would-be assailant left his getaway car in our driveway, engines still running. He was quickly apprehended. That experience lasted only 45 seconds, but aspects of it are indelibly impressed in my memory, from the outline of the young man's coat to the shape of his firearm. Does it matter to learning if we pay attention? The short answer is, you bet it does. My brain fully aroused, I will never forget that experience as long as I live. The more attention the brain pays to a given stimulus, the more elaborately the information will be encoded and retained. That has implications for your employees, your students, and your kids. A strong link between attention and learning has been shown in classroom research both 100 years ago and as recently as last week. The story is consistent. Whether you are an eager preschooler or a bored out-of-your-mind undergraduate, better attention always equals better learning. It improves retention of reading material, accuracy, and clarity during writing, math, and science scores, every academic category that has ever been tested. So, I ask this question of every college course I teach. Given a class of medium interest, not too boring, not too exciting, when do you start glancing at the clock, wondering when the class will be over? There is always some nervous shuffling, a few smiles, and then a lot of silence. Eventually someone blurts out, 10 minutes, Dr. Medina! Why 10 minutes? I inquire. That's when I start to lose attention. That's when I begin to wonder when this torment will be over. The comments are always said in frustration. A college lecture is still about 50 minutes long. Peer-reviewed studies confirm my informal inquiry. Before the first quarter hour is over in a typical presentation, people have usually checked out. If keeping someone's interest in a lecture were a business, it would have an 80% failure rate. What happens at the 10-minute mark to cause such trouble? Nobody knows. The brain seems to be making choices according to some stubborn timing pattern, undoubtedly influenced by both culture and gene. This fact suggests a teaching and business imperative. Find a way to arouse and then hold somebody's attention for a specific period of time. But how? To answer that question, we will need to explore some very complex pieces of neurological real estate. We are about to investigate the remarkable world of human attention, including what's going on in our brains when we turn our attention to something, the importance of emotions, and the myth of multitasking. Can I have your attention, please? While you are hearing these words, millions of sensory neurons in your brain are firing simultaneously, all carrying messages, each attempting to grab your attention. Only a few will succeed in breaking through to your awareness, and the rest will be ignored, either in part or in full. Incredibly, it is easy for you to alter this balance, effortlessly granting airplay to one of the many messages you were previously ignoring. While hearing the sentence, can you feel where your elbows are right now? The messages that do grab your attention are connected to memory, interest, and awareness. Memory. What we pay attention to is often profoundly influenced by memory. In everyday life, we use previous experience to predict where we should pay attention. Different environments create different expectations. This was profoundly illustrated by the scientist Jared Diamond in his book Guns, Germs, and Steel. He describes an adventure traipsing through the New Guinea jungle with native New Guineans. He relates that these natives tend to perform poorly at tasks Westerners have been trained to do since childhood. But they are hardly stupid. These natives can detect the most subtle changes in the jungle, good for following the trail of a predator or the way back home. They know which insects to leave alone, know where food exists, can erect and tear down shelters with ease. Diamond, who had never spent time in such places, has no ability to pay attention to these things. Were he to be tested on such tasks, he also would perform poorly. Culture matters too, even when the physical ecologies are similar. For example, urban Asians viewing visual scenes pay a great deal of attention to the context of the scene and to the relationships between foreground objects and backgrounds. Urban Americans don't. Americans pay attention to the focal items first before the backgrounds, leaving perceptions of context much weaker. Whether in school or business, these differences can greatly affect how an audience perceives a given presentation. Interest. Happily, there are some commonalities regardless of culture. For example, we have known for a long time that interest, or importance, is inextricably linked to attention. Researchers sometimes call this arousal. Exactly how it relates to attention is still a mystery. Does interest create attention? We know that the brain continuously scans the sensory horizon, with events constantly assessed for their potential interest or importance. The more important events are then given extra attention. Can the reverse occur? With attention creating interest? Marketing professionals think so. They have known for years that novel stimuli, the unusual, unpredictable, or distinctive, are powerful ways to harness attention in the service of interest. One well-known example is a print ad for Sauza Commemorativo Tequila. It shows a single picture of an old, dirty, bearded man donning a brimmed hat and smiling broadly, revealing a mouth with only a single tooth. Printed above the mouth is, "This man only has one cavity." A sentence below, set in larger print, is the line, "Life is harsh. Your tequila shouldn't be." Flying in the face of most tequila marketing strategies, which usually consist of scantily clad 20-somethings dancing at a party, the ad is very effective at using attention to create interest. Awareness. Of course, we must be aware of something for it to grab our attention. You can imagine how tough it is to research such an ephemeral concept. We don't know the neural location of consciousness, loosely defined as that part of the mind where awareness resides. The best data suggests several systems are scattered throughout the brain. We have a long way to go before we fully understand the biology behind attention. One famous physician who has examined awareness at the clinical level is Dr. Oliver Sacks. He is a delightful British neurologist and one terrific storyteller. One of his most intriguing clinical cases was first described in his best-selling book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Sacks describes a wonderful older woman in his care, intelligent, articulate, and gifted with a sense of humor. She suffered a massive stroke in the back region of her brain that left her with a most unusual deficit. She lost the ability to pay attention to anything that was to her left. She could pick up objects only in the right half of her visual field. She could put lipstick on only the right half of her face. She ate only from the right half of her plate. This caused her to complain to the hospital nursing staff that her portions were too small. Only when the plate was turned and the food entered her right visual field could she pay any attention to it and have her fill. Data like these are very useful to both clinicians and scientists. When damage occurs to a specific brain region, we know that any observed behavioral abnormality must in some way be linked to that region's function. Examining a broad swath of patients like Sachs's gave scientists a cumulative view of how the brain pays attention to things. Here, in general terms, is what they have found. The brain can be divided roughly into two hemispheres of unequal function, and patients can get strokes in either. Marcel Mesulam of Northwestern University found that the hemispheres contain separate spotlights for visual attention. The left hemisphere spotlight is small, capable of paying attention only to items on the right side of the visual field. The right hemisphere, however, has a global spotlight. According to Mesulam, getting a stroke on the left side is much less catastrophic because the right side can pitch in under duress to aid vision. Of course, sight is only one stimulus to which the brain is capable of paying attention. Just let a bad smell into the room for a moment, or hear a loud noise, and we will easily shift attention. Schools and businesses could take advantage of more than just hearing and vision. We also pay close attention to our psychological interiors, mulling over internal events and feelings again and again with complete focus, with no obvious external sensory stimulation. So, what's going on in our heads when we turn our attention to something? Red alert.
30 years ago, a scientist by the name of Michael Posner derived a theory about attention that remains popular today. Posner started his research career in physics, joining the Boeing Aircraft Company soon out of college.
His first major research contribution was to figure out how to make jet engine noises less annoying to passengers riding in commercial airplanes. You can thank your relatively quiet airborne ride, even if the screaming turbine is only a few feet from your eardrums, in part on Mike's first research efforts. His work on planes eventually led him to wonder about how the brain processes information of any kind. This led him to a doctorate in research and to a powerful idea. Sometimes jokingly referred to as the Trinity model, Posner hypothesized that we pay attention to things because of the existence of three separable but fully integrated systems in the brain. One pleasant Saturday morning, my wife and I were sitting on our outdoor deck, watching a robin drink from our bird bath, when all of a sudden we heard a giant swoosh above our heads. Looking up, we caught the shadow of a red-tailed hawk, dropping like a thunderbolt from its perch in a nearby tree, grabbing the helpless robin by the throat. As the raptor swooped by us, not 3 feet away, blood from the robin spattered on our table. What started out as a leisurely repast ended up as a violent reminder of the savagery of the real world. We were stunned into silence. In Posner's model, the brain's first system functions like the two-part job of a museum security officer, surveillance and alert. He called it the alerting or arousal network. It monitors the sensory environment for any unusual activity. This is the general level of attention our brains are paying attention to our world, a condition termed intrinsic alertness. My wife and I were using this network as we sipped our coffee, watching the robin. If the system detects something unusual, such as the hawk's swoosh, it can sound an alarm heard brain-wide. That's when intrinsic alertness transforms into specific attention called phasic alertness. After the alarm, we orient ourselves to the attending stimulus, activating the second network. We may turn our heads toward the stimulus, perk up our ears, perhaps move toward or away from something. It's why both my wife and I immediately lifted our heads away from the robin, attending to the growing shadow of the hawk. The point is to gain more information about the stimulus, which will allow the brain to make decisions about what to do. Posner termed this the orienting network. The third system, the executive network, controls the, oh my gosh, what should I do now, behaviors. These may include setting priorities, planning on the fly, controlling impulses, weighing the consequences of our actions, or simply shifting attention. For my wife and me, it was stunned silence. So, we have the ability to detect a new stimulus. We have the ability to turn toward it, and the ability to decide what to do based on its nature. Posner's model offered testable predictions about brain function and attention, leading to neurological discoveries that would fill volumes. Hundreds of behavioral characteristics have since been discovered as well. Let's look at three of these characteristics that have considerable practical potential: emotions, multitasking, and timing issues. Number one, emotions get our attention. Emotionally arousing events tend to be better remembered than neutral events. While this idea may seem intuitively obvious, it's frustrating to demonstrate scientifically, because the research community is still debating exactly what an emotion is. One important area of research is the effect of emotion on learning. An emotionally charged event, usually called an ECS, short for emotionally competent stimulus, is the best processed kind of external stimulus ever measured. Emotionally charged events persist much longer in our memories and are recalled with greater accuracy than neutral memories. This characteristic has been used to great effect, and sometimes with great controversy, in television advertising. Consider another memorable commercial, a spot advertising the Volkswagen Passat. The commercial opens with two men talking in a car. They are having a mildly heated discussion about one of them overusing the word like in conversation. As the argument continues, the viewer notices out of the passenger window another car barreling toward the men. It smashes into them. There are screams, sounds of shattering glass, quick-cut shots showing the men bouncing in the car, twisted metal. The exit shot shows the men standing, in disbelief, outside their wrecked Volkswagen. In a twist on a well-known expletive, these words flash on the screen. Safe happens. The spot ends with a picture of another Passat, this one intact and complete with its 5-star side crash safety rating. It is a very memorable, even disturbing, 30-second spot, and it has these characteristics because its centerpiece is an ECS. How does this work in our brains? If the prefrontal cortex is the board chairman, the cingulate gyrus is its personal assistant. The assistant provides the chairman with certain filtering functions and assists in teleconferencing with other parts of the brain, especially the amygdala, which helps create and maintain human emotions. The amygdala is chock full of the neurotransmitter dopamine, and it uses dopamine the way an office assistant uses post-it notes. When an emotionally charged event is detected, the amygdala releases dopamine into the system. Because dopamine greatly aids memory and information processing, you could say the post-it note reads, "Remember this." Getting the brain to put a chemical post-it note on a given body of information means that information is going to be more robustly processed. It is the dream of every teacher, parent, and ad executive. Emotionally charged events can be divided into two categories, those that no two people experience identically and those that everybody experiences identically. When my mother got angry, which was rare, she often went to the kitchen, washing loudly any dishes she discovered in the sink. And if there were pots and pans, she would deliberately crash them together as she put them away. This noise served to announce to the entire household, if not the city block, her displeasure at something. To this day, whenever I hear loudly clanging pots and pans, I experience an emotionally competent stimulus, a fleeting sense of, "You're in trouble now." My wife, whose mother never displayed anger in this fashion, does not associate anything emotional with the noise of pots and pans. It's a uniquely stimulated, John-specific ECS. Universally experienced stimuli come directly from our evolutionary heritage, so they hold the greatest potential for use in teaching and business. Not surprisingly, they follow strict Darwinian lines of threats and energy resources. Regardless of who you are, the brain pays a great deal of attention to these questions. Can I eat it? Will it eat me? Can I mate with it? Will it mate with me? Have I seen it before? Any of our ancestors who didn't remember threatening experiences thoroughly, or adequately acquire food, or pass on his genes, would not live as long as those who did. The human brain has many dedicated systems exquisitely tuned to reproductive opportunity and to the perception of threat. That's why the robbery story grabbed your attention, and why I put it at the beginning of this chapter. We are also terrific pattern matchers, constantly assessing our environment for similarities of experience, and we tend to remember things if we think we have seen them before. One of the best TV spots ever made used all three principles in an ever-increasing spiral. Stephen Hayden produced the commercial introducing the Apple computer in 1984. It won every major advertising award that year and set a standard for Super Bowl ads. The commercial opens onto a bluish auditorium filled with robot-like men, all dressed alike. In a reference to the 1956 movie 1984, the men are staring at a screen where a giant male face is spouting off platitude fragments such as "information purification" and "unification of thought." The men in the audience are absorbing these messages like zombies. After a few seconds, the camera shifts to a young woman in gym clothes, wearing red shorts, the only primary color allowed in the entire commercial. Sledgehammer in hand, she is running full tilt toward the auditorium. Sprinting down the center aisle, she throws her powerful sledgehammer at the screen containing Big Brother. The screen explodes in a hail of sparks and blinding light. A message in plain letters flashes to the screen. On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you will see why 1984 won't be like 1984. All the elements work here. Nothing could be more threatening to a country marinated in free speech than George Orwell's 1984 totalitarian society. There is sex appeal with the revealing gym shorts, but there's a twist. Mac is a female, so IBM must be a male. In the female empowering 1980s, a whopping statement on the battle of the sexes suddenly takes center stage. Pattern matching abounds as well. Many people have read 1984 or seen the movie. Moreover, people who were really into computers at the time made the connection to IBM, a company often called Big Blue for its suit-clad sales force. Meaning before details. The characteristic that most people remember about that commercial is its emotional appeal, even at the expense of detail. There is a reason for this. We remember the emotional components of memory better than any other aspect of the experience. We might forget minute details of an interstate fender bender, for example, yet vividly recall the fear of trying to get to the shoulder without further mishap. Studies show that emotional arousal focuses attention on the gist of an experience at the expense of the peripheral details. Many researchers think that's how memory normally works, by recording the gist of what we encounter, not by retaining a literal record of the experience. With the passage of time, our retrieval of gist always trumps our recall of details. This means our heads are usually filled with the generalized pictures of concepts or events, not with the slowly fading minutiae. I am convinced that America's love of retrieval game shows like Jeopardy exists because we are dazzled by the unusual people who can invert this tendency. Of course, at work and at school, detailed knowledge is often critical for success. And our reliance on gist may actually be fundamental to finding a strategy for remembering details. We know this from a fortuitous series of meetings that occurred in the 1980s between two unlikely individuals, a brain scientist and a waiter. Watching J.C. take an order is like watching Ken Jennings play Jeopardy. J.C. never writes anything down, yet he never gets the order wrong. As the menu offers over 500 possible combinations of food, entrees, side dishes, salad dressing, and so on, per customer, this is an extraordinary achievement. J.C. has been measured taking the orders of 20 people consecutively with a 0% error rate. J.C. worked in a restaurant frequented by University of Colorado brain scientist K. Anders Ericsson. Noticing how unusual J.C.'s skills were, he asked J.C. if he would submit to being studied. The secret of J.C.'s success lay in the deployment of a powerful organization strategy. He always divided the customer's order into discrete categories, such as entree, temperature, side dish, and so on. He then coded the details of a particular order using a lettering system. For salad dressing, blue cheese was always B, Thousand Island always T, and so on. Using this code with the other parts of the menu, he assigned the letters to an individual face and remembered the assignment. By creating a hierarchy of gist, he could easily apprehend the details and never get anything wrong. JC's strategy employs a principle well known in the brain science community. Memory is enhanced by creating associations between concepts. This experiment has been done hundreds of times, always achieving the same result. Words presented in a logically organized, hierarchical structure are much better remembered than words placed randomly, typically 40% better. This result baffles scientists to this day. Embedding associations between data points necessarily increases the number of items to be memorized. With more pieces of intellectual baggage to inventory, it should make learning more difficult. And that is exactly not what is found. If we can derive the meaning of the words to one another, we can much more easily recall the details, meaning before details. John Bransford, a gifted education researcher who edited the well-received How People Learn, one day asked a very simple question. In a given academic discipline, what separates novices from experts? It took him many years to arrive at the final answer, but John eventually discovered six characteristics. When novices started to pick up on these six good habits, they too became experts. One of these habits is quite relevant to our discussion. Experts' knowledge is not simply a list of facts and formulas that are relevant to their domain. Instead, their knowledge is organized around core concepts or big ideas that guide their thinking about their domains. Whether you are a waiter or a brain scientist, the brain rule is just the same. If you want to get the particulars correct, don't start with the details. Instead, start with the key ideas and, in a hierarchical fashion, form the details around these larger notions. Number two, the brain cannot multitask.
Multitasking, when it comes to paying attention, is a myth. The brain naturally focuses on concepts sequentially, one at a time. At first, that might sound confusing. At one level, the brain does multitask. You can walk and talk at the same time. Your brain controls your heartbeat while you read a book. Pianists can play a piece with left hand and right hand simultaneously. Surely this is multitasking. But I am talking about the brain's ability to pay attention. It is the resource you forcibly deploy while trying to listen to a boring lecture at school. It is the activity that collapses as your brain wanders during a tedious presentation at work. This attentional ability is not capable of multitasking.
Recently, I agreed to help the high school son of a friend of mine with some homework, and I don't think I will ever forget the experience. Eric had been working for about a half hour on his laptop when I was ushered to his room. An iPod was dangling from his neck, the earbuds cranking out Tom Petty, Bob Dylan, and Green Day as his left hand reflexively tapped the backbeat. The laptop had at least 11 windows open, including two IM screens carrying simultaneous conversations with MySpace friends. Another window was busy downloading an image from Google. The window behind it had the results of some graphic he was altering for MySpace friend number two, and the one behind that held an old Pong game paused in mid-ping. Buried in the middle of this activity was a word processing program holding the contents of the paper for which I was to provide assistance. "The music helps me concentrate," Eric declared, taking a call on his cell phone. "I normally do everything at school, but I'm stuck. Thanks for coming." Stuck indeed. Eric would make progress on a sentence or two, then type out a MySpace message, then see if the download was finished, then return to his paper. Clearly, Eric wasn't concentrating on his paper. Does Eric sound like a kid you know? An employee? As a parent or as a leader, here's what you need to realize. To put it bluntly, research shows that we can't multitask. We are biologically incapable of processing attention-rich inputs simultaneously, which means that Eric and the rest of us must jump from one thing to the next. To understand this remarkable conclusion, we must delve a little deeper into the third of Posner's trinity, the executive network. Let's look at what Eric's executive network is doing as he works on his paper and then gets interrupted by a "you've got mail" prompt from his girlfriend, Emily. Step number one, shift alert. To write the paper from a cold start, blood quickly rushes to the anterior prefrontal cortex in Eric's head. This area of the brain, part of the executive network, works just like a switchboard, alerting the brain that it's about to shift attention. Step number two, rule activation for task number one. Embedded in the alert is a two-part message sent crackling through Eric's brain. The first is a search query to find the neurons capable of executing the paper-writing task. The second part encodes a command that will rouse the neurons once discovered. The entire process is called rule activation, and it takes several tenths of a second to accomplish. Eric now begins to write his paper. Step number three, disengagement. While typing, Eric's sensory systems picks up the email alert from his girlfriend. Since the rules for writing a paper are different from the rules for writing to Emily, Eric's brain must disengage from the paper writing rules before he can respond. This occurs. The switchboard is consulted, alerting the brain that another shift in attention is about to happen. Step number four, rule activation for task number two. Another two-part message seeking the rule activation protocols for emailing Emily is now deployed. As before, the first is a command to find the writing Emily rules, and the second is the activation command. Now Eric can pour his heart out to his sweetheart. As before, it takes several tenths of a second simply to perform the switch. Incredibly, these four steps must occur in sequence every time Eric switches from one task to another. It is time-consuming, and it is sequential. That's why we can't multitask. That's why people find themselves losing track of previous progress and needing to start over, perhaps muttering things like, "Now where was I?" each time they switch tasks. The best you can say is that people who appear to be good at multitasking actually have good working memories, capable of paying attention to several inputs one at a time. Here's why that matters. Studies show that a person who is interrupted takes 50% longer to accomplish a task. Not only that, he or she makes up to 50% more errors. Some people, particularly younger people, are more adept at task switching. And if a person is familiar with the tasks, the completion time and errors are much less than if the tasks being switched are unfamiliar. Still, taking your sequential brain into a multitasking environment can be like trying to put your right foot into your left shoe. Take driving while talking on a cell phone. Until researchers started measuring the effects of cell phone distractions under controlled conditions, nobody had any idea how profoundly they can impair a driver. It's like driving drunk. Recall that large fractions of a second are consumed every time the brain switches tasks. Cell phone talkers are a half second slower to hit the brakes in emergencies, slower to return to normal speed after an emergency, and more wild in their following distance behind the vehicle in front of them. In a half second, a driver going 70 miles per hour travels 51 feet. Given that 80% of crashes happen within 3 seconds of some kind of driver distraction, increasing your amount of task switching increases your risk of having an accident. More than 50% of the visual cues spotted by attentive drivers are missed by cell phone talkers. Not surprisingly, they get in more wrecks than anyone except very drunk drivers. It isn't just talking on a cell phone, it's putting on makeup, eating, rubbernecking at an accident. One study showed that simply reaching for an object while driving a car multiplies the risk of a crash or a near crash by 9 times. Given what we know about the attention capacity of the human brain, these data are not surprising. Number 3. The brain needs a break. Our need for timed interruptions reminds me of a film called Mondo Cane, which holds the distinction of being the worst movie my parents ever reported seeing. Their sole reason for hating this movie was one disturbing scene. Farmers force-feeding geese to make pâté de foie gras. With fairly vigorous strokes, food was literally stuffed down the throats of these poor animals with a pole. When a goose wanted to regurgitate, a brass ring was tied around its throat, trapping the food inside the digestive tract. Jammed over and over again, such nutrient oversupply eventually created a stuffed liver, pleasing to chefs around the world. Of course, it did nothing for the nourishment of the geese, who were sacrificed in the name of expediency. My mother would often relate this story to me when she talked about being a good or bad teacher. "Most teachers overstuff their students," she would exclaim, "like those farmers in that awful movie." When I went to college, I soon discovered what she meant, and now that I am a professor who has worked closely with the business community, I can see the habit close up. The most common communication mistakes? Relating too much information with not enough time devoted to connecting the dots. Lots of force feeding, very little digestion. This does nothing for the nourishment of the listeners, whose learning is often sacrificed in the name of expediency. At one level, this is understandable. Most experts are so familiar with their topic that they forget what it is like to be a novice. Even if they remember, experts can become bored with having to repeat the fundamentals over and over again. In college, I found that a lot of my professors, because they had to communicate at such elementary levels, were truly fed up with teaching. They seemed to forget that the information was brand new to us and that we needed the time to digest it, which meant a need for consistent breaks. How true indeed that expertise does not guarantee good teaching. Such needs are not the case just in classrooms. I have observed similar mistakes in sermons, boardrooms, sales pitches, media stories, anywhere information from an expert needs to be transferred to a novice. Ideas. The 10-minute rule provides a way out of these problems. Here's the model I developed for giving a lecture, for which I was named the Hirst Marion Russell Teacher of the Year. Lecture design. 10-minute segments. I decided that every lecture I'd ever give would come in discrete modules. Since the 10-minute rule had been known for many years, I decided the modules would last only 10 minutes. Each segment would cover a single core concept, always large, always general, always filled with gist, and always explainable in 1 minute. Since there were 50 minutes in a class, I could easily burn through 5 large concepts in a single period. I would use the other 9 minutes in the segment to provide a detailed description of that single general concept. The trick was to ensure that each detail could be traced easily back to the general concept with minimal intellectual effort. I regularly took time out from content to explain the relationship between the detail and the core concept in clear and explicit terms. It was like allowing the geese to rest between stuffings. Then came the hardest part. After 10 minutes had elapsed, I had to be finished with the core concept. Why did I construct it that way? 3 reasons. Number 1, Given the tendency of an audience to check out 20% of the way into a presentation, I knew I initially had only about 600 seconds to earn the right to be heard, or the next hour would be useless. I needed to do something after the 601st second to buy another 10 minutes. Number two, the brain processes meaning before detail. Providing the gist, the core concept, first was like giving a thirsty person a tall glass of water. And the brain likes hierarchy. Starting with general concepts naturally leads to explaining information in a hierarchical fashion. You have to do the general idea first, and then you will see that 40% improvement in understanding. It's key that the instructor explains the lecture plan at the beginning of the class, with liberal repetitions of where we are sprinkled throughout the hour. This prevents the audience from trying to multitask. If the instructor presents a concept without telling the audience where that concept fits into the rest of the presentation, the audience is forced to simultaneously listen to the instructor and attempt to divine where it fits into the rest of what the instructor is saying. This is the pedagogical equivalent of trying to drive while talking on a cell phone. Since it is impossible to do any two things at once, this will cause a series of millisecond delays throughout the presentation. The linkages must be clearly and repetitively explained. Bait the hook. After 9 minutes and 59 seconds, the audience's attention is getting ready to plummet to near zero. If something isn't done quickly, the students will end up in successively losing bouts of an effort to stay with me. What do they need? Not more information of the same type. That would be like geese choking on the food with no real chance to digest. They also don't need some completely irrelevant cue that breaks them from their train of thought, making the information stream seem disjointed, unorganized, and patronizing. They need something so compelling that they blast through the 10-minute barrier and move on to new ground, something that triggers an orienting response toward the speaker and captures executive functions, allowing efficient learning. Do we know anything so potentially compelling? We sure do. The ECS, Emotionally Competent Stimuli. So, every 10 minutes in my lecture, I decided to give my audiences a break from the fire hose of information and send them a relevant ECS, which I ended up calling hooks. As I did more teaching, I found the most successful hooks always follow these three principles. Number one, the hook had to trigger an emotion. Fear, laughter, happiness, nostalgia, incredulity, the entire emotional palette could be stimulated, and all worked well. I deliberately employed Darwin here, describing some threatening event, or with appropriate taste, some reproductive event, even something triggering pattern matching. Narratives can be especially strong, especially if they are crisp and to the point. Number two, the hook had to be relevant. It couldn't be just any story or anecdote. If I simply cracked a joke or delivered some irrelevant anecdote every 10 minutes, the presentation seemed disjointed. Or worse, the listeners began to mistrust my motives. They seemed to feel as if I were trying to entertain them at the expense of providing information. Audiences are really good at detecting disorganization, and they can become furious if they feel patronized. Happily, I found that if I made the hook very relevant to the provided content, the group moved from feeling entertained to feeling engaged. They stayed in the flow of my material, even though they were really taking a break. Number three, the hook had to go between modules. I could place it at the end of the 10 minutes, looking backwards, summarizing the material, repeating some aspect of the content. Or I could place it at the beginning of the module, looking forward, introducing new material, anticipating some aspect of content. I found that starting a lecture with a forward-looking hook relevant to the entire day's material was a great way to corral the attention of the class. Exactly what did these hooks look like? This is where teaching can truly become imaginative. Because I work with psychiatric issues, case histories explaining some unusual mental pathology often rivet students to the upcoming and drier material. Business-related anecdotes can be fun, especially when addressing lay audiences in the corporate world. I often illustrate a talk about how brain science relates to business by addressing its central problem, vocabulary. I like the anecdote of the Electrolux vacuum cleaner company, a privately held corporation in Finland trying to break into the North American market. They had plenty of English speakers on staff, but no Americans. Their lead marketing slogan? If it sucks, it must be an Electrolux. When I started placing hooks in my lectures, I immediately noted changes in the audience members' attitudes. First, they were still interested at the end of the first 10 minutes. Second, they seemed able to maintain their attention for another 10 minutes or so, as long as another hook was supplied at the end. I could win the battle for their attention in 10-minute increments. But then, halfway through the lecture, after I'd deployed two or three hooks, I found I could skip the fourth and fifth ones and still keep their attention fully engaged. I have found this to be true for students in 1994, when I first used the model, and in my lectures to this day. Does that mean my model has harnessed the timing and power of emotional salience in human learning? That teachers and business professionals everywhere should drop whatever they are doing and incorporate its key features? I have no idea. But it would make sense to find out. The brain doesn't pay attention to boring things, and I am as sick of boring presentations as you are.
For your review, here's a summary of the chapter. Let's review the chapter.
Attention. Rule number 6. People don't pay attention to boring things. The brain's attentional spotlight can focus on only one thing at a time. No multitasking. We are better at seeing patterns and abstracting the meaning of an event than we are at recording detail. Emotional arousal helps the brain learn. Audiences check out after 10 minutes, but you can keep grabbing them back by telling narratives or creating events rich in emotion.
A tutorial of the chapter is available at www.brainrulesbook.com.
Memory. Rule number 7. Repeat to remember. It is the ultimate intellectual flattery to be born with a mind so amazing that brain scientists voluntarily devote their careers to study it. This impressive feat occurred with the owners of two such minds in the past century, and their remarkable brains provide insight into human memory. The first mind belongs to a man named Kim Peake. He was born in 1951, with not one hint of his future intellectual greatness. He has an enlarged head, no corpus callosum, and a damaged cerebellum. He could not walk until age 4, and he can get catastrophically upset when he doesn't understand something, which is often. Diagnosing him in his early childhood as mentally disabled, his doctors initially wanted to place him in a mental institution. That didn't happen, mostly because of the nurturing efforts of Peake's father, who recognized that his son also had some very special intellectual gifts. One of those intellectual gifts is memory. Peake has one of the most prodigious ever recorded. He can read two pages at the same time, one with each eye, comprehending and remembering perfectly everything contained in the pages, forever. Though publicity shy, Peake's dad once granted writer Barry Morrow an interview with his son. It was conducted in a library, where Peake demonstrated to Morrow a familiarity with literally every book and every author in the building. He then started quoting ridiculous and highly accurate amounts of sports trivia. After a long discussion about the histories of certain United States wars, revolutionary to Vietnam, Morrow felt he had enough. He decided right then and there to write a screenplay about this man, which he did, the Oscar-winning film Rain Man. What is going on in the uneven brain of Kim Peake? Does his mind belong in a cognitive freak show? Or is it only an extreme example of normal human learning? Something very important is occurring in the first few moments his brain is exposed to information, and it's not so very different from what happens to the rest of us in the initial moments of learning.
The first few moments of learning give us the ability to remember something. The brain has different types of memory systems, many operating in a semi-autonomous fashion. We know so little about how they coordinate with each other that, to this date, memory is not considered a unitary phenomenon. We know the most about declarative memory, which involves something you can declare, such as, the sky is blue. This type of memory involves 4 steps: encoding, storage, retrieval, and forgetting.
This chapter is about the first one. In fact, it is about the first few seconds of the first step. They are crucial in determining whether something that is initially perceived will also be remembered. Memory has been the subject of poets and philosophers for centuries. At one level, memory is like an invading army, allowing past experiences to intrude continuously onto present life. That's fortunate. Our brains do not come fully assembled at birth, which means that most of what we know about the world has to be either experienced by us firsthand or taught to us secondhand. Our robust memory can provide great survival advantages. It is in large part why we've succeeded in overpopulating the planet. For a creature as physically weak as humans, compare your fingernail with the claw of even a simple cat and weep with envy. Not allowing experience to shape our brains would have meant almost certain death in the rough and tumble world of the open savanna. But memory is more than a Darwinian chess piece. Most researchers agree that its broad influence on our brains is what truly makes us consciously aware. The names and faces of our loved ones, our own personal tastes, and especially our awareness of those names and faces and tastes are maintained through memory. We don't go to sleep and then, upon awakening, have to spend a week relearning the entire world. Memory does this for us. Even the single most distinctive talent of human cognition, the ability to write and speak in a language, exists because of active remembering. Memory, it seems, makes us not only durable, but also human. So how does it work? When researchers want to measure memory, they usually end up measuring retrieval. That's because in order to find out if somebody has committed something to memory, you have to ask if he or she can recall it. But how do people recall things? Does the storage space carrying the record of some experience just sit there, twiddling its thumbs in our brains, waiting for some command to trot out its contents? Can we investigate storage separately from retrieval? It has taken more than 100 years of research just to get a glimmer of a definition of memory that makes sense to a scientist. The story began in the 19th century with a German researcher who performed the first real science-based inquiry into human memory. He did the whole thing with his own brain. Hermann Ebbinghaus was born in 1850. As a young man, he looked like a cross between Santa Claus and John Lennon, with his bushy brown beard and round glasses. He is most famous for uncovering one of the most depressing facts in all of education. People usually forget 90% of what they learn in a class within 30 days. He further showed that the majority of this forgetting occurs within the first few hours after class. This has been robustly confirmed in modern times. Ebbinghaus designed a series of experimental protocols with which a toddler might feel at ease. He made up lists of nonsense words, 2,300 of them. Each word consisted of three letters and a consonant-vowel-consonant construction, such as T-A-Z, L-E-F, R-E-N, Z-U-G. He then spent the rest of his life trying to memorize lists of these words in varying combinations and with varying lengths. With the tenacity of a Prussian infantryman, which for a short time he was, Ebbinghaus recorded for over 30 years his successes and failures. He uncovered many important things about human learning in this journey. He showed that memories have different lifespans. Some memories hang around only for a few minutes, then vanish. Others persist for days or months, even for a lifetime. He also showed that one could increase the lifespan of a memory simply by repeating the information in timed intervals. The more repetition cycles a given memory experienced, the more likely it was to persist in his mind. We now know that the space between repetitions is the critical component for transforming temporary memories into more persistent forms. Spaced learning is greatly superior to massed learning. Ebbinghaus's work was foundational. It was also incomplete. It did not, for example, separate the notion of memory from retrieval, the difference between learning something and recalling it later. Go ahead and try to remember your social security number. Easy enough? Your retrieval commands might include things like visualizing the last time you saw the card, or remembering the last time you wrote down the number. Now try to remember how to ride a bike. Easy enough? Hardly. You do not call up a protocol list detailing where you put your foot, how to create the correct angle for your back, where your thumbs are supposed to be. The contrast proves an interesting point. One does not recall how to ride a bike in the same way one recalls 9 numbers in a certain order. The ability to ride a bike seems quite independent from any conscious recollection of the skill. You were consciously aware when you were remembering your social security number, but not when riding a bike. Do you need to have conscious awareness in order to experience a memory? Or is there more than one type of memory? The answer seemed clearer as more data came in. The answer to the first question was no. You don't have to be consciously aware in order to have a memory. These findings answered the second question. There are at least 2 types of memories, memories that involve conscious awareness and memories that don't. This awareness distinction gradually morphed into the idea that there were memories you could declare and there were memories you could not declare. Declarative memories are those that can be experienced in our conscious awareness, such as this shirt is green, Jupiter is a planet, or even a list of words. Non-declarative memories are those that cannot be experienced in our conscious awareness, such as the motor skills necessary to ride a bike. This does not explain everything about human memory. It does not even explain everything about declarative memory. But the rigor of Ebbinghaus gave future scientists their first real shot at mapping behavior onto a living brain. Then, a 9-year-old boy was knocked off his bicycle, forever changing the way brain scientists thought about memory. Where memories go. In his accident, H.M. suffered a severe head injury that left him with epileptic seizures. These seizures got worse with age, eventually culminating in one major seizure and 10 blackout periods every 7 days. By his late 20s, H.M. was essentially dysfunctional, of potential great harm to himself, and in need of drastic medical intervention. The desperate family turned to famed neurosurgeon William Scoville, who decided that the problem lay within the brain's temporal lobe, the brain region roughly located behind your ears. Scoville excised the inner surface of this lobe on both sides of the brain. This experimental surgery greatly helped the epilepsy. It also left H.M. with a catastrophic memory loss. Since the day the surgery was completed, in 1953, H.M. has been unable to convert a new short-term memory into a long-term memory. He can meet you once, and then, an hour or two later, meet you again, with absolutely no recall of the first visit. He has lost the conversion ability Ebbinghaus so clearly described in his research more than 50 years before. Even more dramatically, H.M. can no longer recognize his own face in the mirror. Why? As his face aged, just like the rest of us, some of his physical features changed. But unlike the rest of us, H.M. cannot take this new information and convert it into a long-term form. This leaves him more or less permanently locked into a single idea about his appearance. When he looks in the mirror and does not see this single idea, he cannot identify to whom the image actually belongs. As horrible as that is for H.M., it is of enormous value to the research community. Because researchers knew precisely what was taken from the brain, it was easy to map which brain regions controlled the Ebbinghaus behaviors. A great deal of credit for this work belongs to Brenda Milner, a psychologist who has spent more than 40 years studying H.M. and has laid the groundwork for much of our understanding about the nerves behind memory. Let's review for a moment the biology of the brain. You recall the cortex, that wafer-thin layer of neural tissue that's about the size of a baby blanket when unfurled. It is composed of 6 discrete layers of cells. It's a busy place. Those cells process signals originating from many parts of the body, including those lassoed by your sense organs. They also help create stable memories, and that's where H.M.'s unfortunate experience becomes so valuable. Some of H.M.'s cortex was left perfectly intact. Other regions, such as his temporal lobe, sustained heavy damage. It was a gruesome but ideal opportunity for studying how human memory forms. This baby blanket doesn't just lay atop of the brain, of course. As if the baby blanket were capable of growing complex, sticky root systems, the cortex adheres to the deeper structures of the brain by a hopelessly incomprehensible thicket of neural connections. One of the most important destinations of these connections is the hippocampus, which is parked near the center of your brain, one in each hemisphere. The hippocampus is specifically involved in converting short-term information into longer-term forms. As you might suspect, it is the very region H.M. lost during his surgery. The anatomical relationship between the hippocampus and the cortex has helped 21st century scientists further define the two types of memory. Declarative memory is any conscious memory system that is altered when the hippocampus and various surrounding regions become damaged. Non-declarative memory is defined as those unconscious memory systems that are not altered, or at least not greatly altered, when the hippocampus and the surrounding regions are damaged. We're going to focus on declarative memory, a vital part of our everyday activities. Sliced and diced. Research shows that the life cycle of declarative memory, as mentioned previously, can be divided into 4 sequential steps: encoding, storing, retrieving, and forgetting. As also mentioned, we are focusing on encoding. Encoding describes what happens at the initial moment of learning, that fleeting golden instant when the brain first encounters a new piece of declarative information. It also involves a whopping fallacy, one in which your brain is an active co-conspirator. Here's an example of this subversion, coming once again from the clinical observations of neurologist Oliver Sacks. The case involves a low-functioning autistic boy named Tom, who has become quite famous for being able to do music, though little else. Tom never received formal instruction in music of any kind, but he learned to play the piano simply by listening to other people. Astonishingly, he could play complex pieces of music with the skill and artistry of accomplished professionals after hearing the music exactly once and doing so on his first try. In fact, he has been observed playing the song Fisher's Hornpipe with his left hand while simultaneously playing Yankee Doodle Dandy with his right hand while simultaneously singing Dixie. He also can play the piano backwards, that is, with his back to the keyboard using inverted hands. Not bad for a boy who cannot even tie his own shoes. When we hear about people like this, we are usually jealous. Tom absorbs music as if he could switch to the on position some neural recording device in his head. We think we also have this video recorder, only our model is not nearly as good. This is a common impression. Most people believe that the brain is a lot like a recording device, that learning is something akin to pushing the record button, and remembering is simply pushing playback. Wrong. In the real world of the brain, Tom's or yours, nothing could be further from the truth. The moment of learning, of encoding, is so mysterious and complex that we have no metaphor to describe what happens to our brains in those first fleeting seconds. The little we do know suggests it is like a blender left running with the lid off. The information is literally diced into discrete pieces as it enters the brain and is splattered all over the insides of our mind. Stated formally, signals from different sensory sources are registered in separate brain areas. The information is fragmented and redistributed the instant the information is encountered. If you look at a complex picture, for example, your brain immediately extracts the diagonal lines from the vertical lines and stores them in separate areas. Same with color. If the picture is moving, the fact of its motion will be extracted and stored in a place separate than if the picture were static.